Thank you for listening to Mormon Sex Info. This episode is an archived episode and is only now becoming publicly available. Mormon Sex Info relies on contributions. To contribute, please visit mormonsex.info. And now, please enjoy this episode.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Mormon Sex Info. This is Natasha Helfer Parker, and today I am thrilled to have with me Gina Ogden. Gina, I consider her really a national treasure. She's an award-winning sex therapist, family therapist, researcher, teacher, author. She's founder of the Relational Sexuality Network, which is an international collaboration of practitioners whose mission is to expand the practice of therapy and sex therapy. She has presented all over the world. She's the author of like 10 books. She's been on media talk shows from things like talk radio to the Oprah Winfrey Show. I'm thrilled that you would be with me today. So welcome, Gina, to the program.
Well, thank you, Natasha. I'm thrilled to be here.
Is there anything else that you would like to say about yourself as far as an introduction that I'm not including?
I think what I would like to say to your, particularly to the Mormon people who may be listening to this, that in full disclosure, I am a lapsed Episcopalian. I'm not a Mormon. And my spirituality, which possibly I'll talk more about as we go along, has developed over the years into something that is very earth-centered and deep, but it's not religious in the sense of having a structured religion around it. And that said, more and more people from the Mormon community seem to be seeking me out and finding me, and I am loving it, because I'm loving the sense of community, and I'm loving the sense of dedication to not only self-exploration, but self-exploration in the context of community and of something larger than ourselves. So, I didn't mean to say all that right up front, but I put it out, so there it is.
No, that's great. I love that you started with that. About half of the people that come on the show do have a Mormon background or are Mormon themselves, and about half don't. So I really want to include a lot of different perspectives. You're right. One of the things that Mormons are good at are seeking information and educating themselves, and they're very open to different perspectives. And I can see why your approach would be very meaningful and attractive to many within the Mormon community. So just thrilled to have you here today. You're the author of a book called The Return of Desire, and today's topic will really be about kind of a very common complaint that we often see come through sex therapy offices, which is that of low desire or wanting to feel more desire, especially from the female perspective. So that's going to be the main topic, and why don't we just dive right in?
Okay. Well, I wrote that book for a variety of reasons, one of which, or the stated of which, was to bring me into consciousness that desire isn't just something that happens physically. You can't really treat it effectively with hormone supplements. So because desire is multidimensional, it affects our bodies, but it also affects our minds, and it affects our emotions and our spirits. I'll talk lots more about that as we get into more questions. But I begin the book with a provocative question, which is desire for what? You know, what is it that women in particular are looking for? Is it hotter sex? Is it to change their partners? Is it intercourse in the context of marriage to create babies? What is it we are looking for? Nobody has the right answers. So that's where I begin.
I love that. And you sent me a link to a poster, which we'll be putting up with this podcast, which kind of addresses this very thing, right? So you have this poster where every sentence starts with "women want," and then the things that they want are vast and wide and contradictory. And, you know, in other words, women can want a lot of different things, and you can't just put women into one particular box. So I really loved that. And I think I'd like for you to start with this concept of how women deal with this idea that it's okay to feel good. That really stood out to me in the beginning of your book, especially because from the context of Mormonism, we have this wonderful scripture in the Book of Mormon that really talks about the plan of God, and that plan includes pleasure, that men are, that they might have joy. And so that's a beautiful basis for why we are created and why we are who we are. At the same time, I often find that goes in conflict with a lot of other principles that we believe in, such as being caretakers, especially as women, the concept of sacrifice, the concept that struggle and trial is supposed to be a part of life, and the importance of motherhood and wifehood versus individual self. So I really liked that question of, is it okay to feel good, and how do we start thinking about that differently?
I love all that you say. I think built into the culture at large, let alone what is revealed through the Mormon church, that women, by and large, it's not okay for women to feel good. We have, through decades, and thanks to the women's movement and the women's health movement, we've earned the right to say no to sex that hurts or sex that may bring us unwanted creepy crawlies, diseases and stuff that we don't want. But we've not yet earned the right to say yes to pleasure. Inbuilt in this society that we live in, I believe there is something I've learned to call cultural missionary position, man on top. And this certainly holds true of our sexuality, that we are trained, again, in society at large, to look for men to dictate what we're supposed to say yes to, and let alone what we're supposed to say no to. So what I've tried to do in this book is to simply fly beneath the radar of all of that cultural training and to say, look, desire, or what we want at any level, and certainly at the sexual level, has to do with listening to our bodies, trusting our emotions, how we feel, how are our hearts open, or how our hearts shrink and close when we're in the presence of darkness in terms of another human being. It also depends on how we think. You know, what are the messages that have come to us, and what messages are we resonating to? I certainly grew up in Boston, Massachusetts, many years ago, which was a very closed-down society, with the strong message that good girls don't. Well, what don't we? What don't we? We don't want pleasure. We don't have sex. We don't ask for what we want. And so I've had to literally overturn probably centuries of that kind of thinking to be able to come out on the other side and say, wait a minute, my body is giving me these clues. My emotions, my heart is opening in this way. And so I need to override some of those early messages to be able to listen to my heart and my body. And then when you close the circle of my four-dimensional model, body, mind, heart, and spirit, and step into that place of spirituality, well, what does that mean? What is spirituality? And I most often define it or describe it as being a place of connection and meaning. And for some people, that spirituality obviously includes religion and religious training and religious commitment. For other people in this culture, it does not. So that certainly is for every person to decide for himself or herself. So if we look at a whole picture of what we want, what we desire, body, mind, heart, and spirit, then we find it's very hard to attach the old rules to it. So this is where I begin, in the wheel, in the what I call the integrative wheel of sexual experience, so that you can literally walk through your own responses, physical, emotional, mental, and spiritual.
Yeah, and this is a model that you've really become quite known for, this four-dimensional wheel approach, and I definitely want to go into that a little bit further. Could you, before we do that, can you talk a little bit about this idea of kind of how we've been taught about sexuality, and you talk about how we're often given a linear model versus a circular model?
So part of the linear aspect of how we're supposed to experience sex comes from way back, probably in prehistory, but from what we are able to discern, it certainly comes up through the Judeo-Christian traditions, where the founding fathers of whatever civilization you happen to be in are trying to preserve the civilization and keep men and women together in order to raise children. And because it's cultural missionary position and men are on top, the men make the rules and the men get to enjoy whatever the fruits of sexuality are, whether they're the children, whether they're the inheritance of land, money, etc. So we get these rules about marriage and the sanctity of marriage. And of course, in every society, these rules have been tweaked and broken and torqued. And now we're living in a society where those rules are in many parts of the country up for grabs, and people are talking about affairs and polyamory, etc. But they all hark back to this kind of single notion that what is right is one man, one woman, and intercourse as the one right way to have sex, which is not always what women want or even what men want. So if we look at a more, as you call it, circular model, and I guess I call it that way, that too, because I'm talking about a wheel, of sexual experience, physical, emotional, mental, spiritual, we begin to expand on that model, which is not to say that marriage between one man and one woman and with requisite intercourse and having children is a bad thing. It simply is not the only thing that it has to do with sexual pleasure. So if somebody comes to me in a group that I run or as a supervisee or very, very occasionally now as a client, I will ask them to explore all of these aspects of their sexual well-being.
Yeah, so let's get into that a little bit. If you don't mind, I'm going to read a little excerpt from your book where you kind of describe some of this, and then you can give us some more maybe examples. But you're talking about a couple that are coming in for her low sexual desire, and you say, "I quickly saw that their issue was more about their dominator conditioning than about her sexual dysfunction. The counseling, of course, then had to involve both of them. I began by explaining the concept of the wheel as a way for them to see that there were multiple areas of their relationship that affected their sexual desire, and the process helped give them language to organize their thoughts and feelings in a way that didn't cast blame on either of them. First on the agenda was helping her demonstrate to him that she was a live, pulsing being of flesh and feeling and movement. A close second on the agenda was helping him sensitize his hands to notice that her body had various warm, soft places. I think one of the complaints was that he just would go straight to the clitoris and start manipulate that without really, yeah, without really tuning
with
into her
fingers.
Right. And I suggested he start with her feet, getting to know each toe and heel, then seeing how many other secrets of her body he could discover before working his way back to her clitoris. This exploration moved him to embark on his own wheel journey of discovery, and he started in the place of emotions to revisit his boyhood messages. The guys don't have feelings, they fix things. Both husband and wife were good-humored, eager to learn, and whizzes at their homework, so counseling turned out to be a win-win situation for them both." That's just such a lovely example of just kind of changing the framework, right? And so talk more about how you use this wheel, and maybe if you want to maybe use examples of how that shows up for people and what you actually mean by working the wheel.
Yeah. Well, thank you for reminding me of that passage. I wrote it a long time ago. And one of the problems is if you write book after book after book, you get sort of hooked on the book you're writing and forget what went before. So this reminds me of how I routinely will invite couples or individuals, but in this case a couple, into the wheel to explore these different aspects of their being and certainly of what they want, or to locate themselves as to where they are now. If, for instance, he's in the emotional place and he's asking for something and she's somewhere else, either feeling really spiritual — I'm now taking a different kind of couple, but let's say it's a woman — and I find this routinely, and I certainly have found it through supervisees in the Mormon community, where the woman — it could be woman or man, but in this case, let's say a woman — is very tied into what she is supposed to be doing, trying to be a good girl. In other words, she's located herself in that spiritual quadrant, and kind of on the cusp of the mental quadrant. So she's resonating to a lot of the messages that tell her what it means to be a good woman, that she's supposed to be a caretaker, she's supposed to be a mom, she's supposed to be pregnant a lot, she's supposed to be there for her husband, not necessarily for herself. And let's say in this couple, the man is feeling really open and wanting something else, wanting something closer with his wife, wanting to know what she wants. And she feels very, very stuck in that religious place where she's being so good. And so what I might do is ask either of them, whichever one is willing to move first, to describe what it is they want, where it from each of the quadrants, so that they're not having this conversation where he's saying, I want you to be more open-hearted, and she's saying, but I want to be a good girl, which is a conversation that just is kind of an endless loop and ends up making for very unhappy unions, sexual, spiritual, and otherwise. So if they can open up their conversation, if she can move, which might be a very daring step for her, so we have to make it really safe. If we can move her into the mental quadrant to begin to differentiate what some of those messages are that she got from her mom, from her dad, from her community, and what she's getting from the church elders, for instance, just to be aware of them. And then ask her to move into the emotional quadrant where she can begin to tune into her heart and what her heart is saying yes to. Yes, I love my husband. Yes, I need my church and I need my community. And I love my church and my community, but maybe in a different way, etc. So we walk through that and walk into the physical quadrant where she can begin to listen to her body, which may be very, very hard for her because she's learned to stay very armored. I mean, literally covered up through garments, through other kind of clothing, and to begin by asking her to breathe and follow her breath, perhaps only down as far as her throat, and then maybe as far as her chest, and then maybe as far as her heart, and to begin to work with her breathing and encourage her to breathe. This might not all happen at first, but ultimately to breathe all the way down into her belly, into her genitals, into her vulva, her thighs, her knees, down through the bottoms of her feet, so she can literally feel the earth and feel, sometimes for the first time, women feel as if they're standing on Mother Earth, literally, and begin to breathe that energy back up through their bodies. Meanwhile, her husband is exploring this by holding space for her. And then she might go around the wheel again with some of this new experience, so that she's differentiated the "I always say no to sex," or "I'm scared of sex," or "I'm being a good girl," whatever those messages are. She's been able to differentiate what parts of her body does she hold sacred? What parts of her body does she open up to pleasure? And to move to the emotions, what part of her heart is she willing to open up to herself and to her beloved, as distinct from the parts of her heart that she opens to the church teachings, or that she opens to her children, or her parents, or any of the other parts of her life that she loves. And then move back into the spiritual quadrant for her to experience by literally standing in that quadrant, feeling the earth beneath her feet. What is it that she is grateful for? How does she feel connected? How does she feel disconnected? What does she want to do in this spiritual quadrant of meaning and connection? As she looks at the physical and emotional and mental parts of her sexual relationship, what does she see? What kind of meaning does she make there? And this is what I mean by walking the wheel. We keep going around or back and forth. For some people get very stuck between the mental and the emotional. They'll get in the mental place, they'll get into all of these shoulds, but you can see that they're feeling angry or frustrated. And when you get them into the emotional to deal with their anger and frustration, they'll go right back into their heads because it's safer for some of us to be in our heads than it is to really open our hearts. So I'll just finish this quickly because it's a long speech. Meanwhile, her partner, her husband, has been seeing these sometimes subtle, sometimes dramatic insights and changes that his wife is making as she walks the wheel. And I'll invite him into the wheel. Where are you now? Literally locating himself. And I may ask him to speak from each quadrant. Certainly the emotional, which is where he started. And he may be so moved that I'll see that the wife is incredibly moved and ask them both to be in that same quadrant together and ask them, what is it you need to communicate to one another in this quadrant? And very often what they need to communicate is way beyond words. It is either physical through some kind of heart-to-heart touching connection, or spiritual, which again is about meaning, which may again be beyond words, and may be very rooted in the Mormonness of their culture, not necessarily rebelling against the Mormonness of their culture and acculturation, but deepening it, expanding it, affirming that the two of them can have it all. In effect, they can be really good members of their community, really productive members of their community and loving members of their community, and they can experience pleasure in their union, including sexual pleasure, which may be way beyond just intercourse. It's a kind of pleasure that will permeate every aspect of their lives and help them to educate their children by example, by seeing mom and dad touching each other and looking at each other and having a really sensual time together that they can have not only with themselves, but within the family. And by this, I am so not saying have sex with the family, that it's It's about a consciousness of pleasure that is, as you pointed out at the beginning, Natasha, much more circular and meandering than it is straight line. This is what we do, and we don't cross the line to what we do not do.
I love so much of what you're saying. In fact, it's actually quite spiritual for me to even just listen to you give this example. I especially like these ideas about expanding definitions and making room for more than what we've maybe scripted ourselves. I think, you know, there's such a spectrum within Mormonism. There's people who are very, very committed to the faith. There's people who are more nuanced in the faith. There's people who are maybe leaving the faith, but still very much find so much of their heritage and culture from the Mormon upbringing that they've had. So there's a huge spectrum here. And I think one of the things that I often come across is so much of what you're talking about, like the good girl script or these romantic scripts. I mean, we can get into some of those scripts that we often apply to our situations subconsciously, but it can be so much more than that. And then there's not one right way to have sexual desire or pleasure. And that I think oftentimes in Mormonism, it's this idea that you're going to fall in love, that even these words that we're using that I love, like sacredness and this specialness and this uniqueness, but it can almost get too holy in a sense, right? Yeah. Like God is too involved in our sex life, so that we're kind of taken aback by the animalistic nature of sexuality or the more primal aspects of sexuality, or because we're feeling like the word sacred or holy have to do with purity or virtue or these things that don't always feel like they intertwine with sexuality.
Well, that have to do with disconnection rather than connection. And I think maybe this is coming from me and is alien to Mormon culture, so you can tell me. But if you believe that God or sacredness or holiness, whatever name you want to give it, is in everything, is in me, is in you, is in, quote, our relationship, is in the earth, is in every stone and rainstorm. If you believe that God is there, then when you come to concepts like love, you can expand your loving to include God, and as well as human. When I did my survey on integrating sexuality and spirituality some 20 years ago, nobody has ever done one before or since. It's a big national survey with some 4,000 respondents. Which included numerous Mormons, by the way. What I found was that all of the respondents, the sort of major finding, was this sense that sexuality and spirituality are connected, and they're connected through our emotions, through our bodies, through our thinking, as well as through this amorphous thing that we call spirituality. And one of the things that I've developed over the 20 years that I've now been teaching the wheel work and wheel walking is I've asked people, this couple, for instance, I would ask to bring in an object that represents what it is they mean by love. If I say to you, if you're my partner, I want you to love me, and you say back, but I do, and my idea of love may be hot chili peppers, a can of hot chili peppers, and your idea of love may be a Raggedy Ann doll with a big heart. And so we're missing connections until we can actually see, sometimes working with the objects literally helps us to take these abstract concepts that we all have in perfectly good faith and use, knowing what they mean usually ourselves, but having no way to really communicate to our partners what they mean. So if we can take an object, whatever it may be, and show our partner and then describe that object, describe what we mean by the object, that's another way of helping partners understand what's going on. We can also use the wheels, so you can describe the object, of course, from the physical point of view, emotional, spiritual, and mental point of view as well.
Yeah, I think that you're spot on when you say that Mormons definitely have a very good base on this idea of having this sex-positive foundation where sexuality is from God, it comes from God, we're created in the image of God, so even our bodies, you know, there's this kind of positive messaging towards bodies. At the same time, I will say that one of our challenges is probably the conditional process that we put on that. So in other words, the right type of sex is from God. And so this is where, you know, masturbation or my spouse is looking at pornography or I have a fantasy that doesn't seem to be very righteous. This is where Mormons can kind of stop that place of acceptance and get very caught up on certain types of sexuality being sanctioned by God and others not. And that becomes an area of distress for them often, especially if they're defining those differently.
So in my workbook, which describes the wheel, I have asked a variety of practitioners to write about cases. And wonderful Kristen Hodson, who's a member of your community and a wonderful wheel worker, writes exactly about this. And the subtitle of what she is writing about is Conversations with God. That ultimately, we can use the wheel to have those conversations with God from our body. Dear God, here is my body. Let's talk. From the emotions, from the heart, from the mind, what are the teachings that are important to me? What are less important to me? What are challenging to me? And certainly from the spirit, where do I feel connected? So using pornography is something that is so totally in our culture at this point, because everybody's got a computer and every computer is filled with porn images if you just go click, click, click. So it's very easy to get hooked on this. And you can look at that behavior as through pathological lenses, or rather through lenses of pathology, and say there's something wrong with you with that behavior. You've got to stop. You're addicted. That's bad. Or you can look at that behavior through the wheel. And what is it? Physical, emotional, mental, spiritual. What is your relationship with all of that material that's in your computer? That is perhaps different from your relationship with your partner or with your church or with yourself. And allow people to find their way through this conversation. And finally, in that spiritual quadrant, to really, I was going to say confront God. It's not to confront God. It's really to converse with God, with the God in oneself and the God that is in all things? And how do I connect with all that is? At that point, or through that process, in my humble opinion, it's possible for people to begin to make whatever their own decisions are around their sexual behaviors, whether those behaviors match what the church dictates or don't match what the church dictates.
Yeah, that's lovely. And actually, the church, for the most part, with marriage, stays kind of out of it. You know, it really does, in some indirect ways, encourage the couple to figure kind of this process out between themselves. At the same time, I think there's obviously some issues that they do take hard lines on, such as pornography, or maybe people assume that the church takes hard lines on these, on certain issues, because of what they were taught as adolescents, you know, et cetera. So,
right. Also, there's from what I understand, and please correct me if I'm wrong, that there is not a lot of emphasis on comprehensive sexuality education for kids at age-appropriate increments, so that by the time you're married, there may be very little kind of background for or experience to tap into. So that, and maybe I find this because I'm a therapist, so that's who I'm meeting. But so that it's almost like there's two kids who are getting married, even though they may be well into their 20s or their 40s by the time I meet them, that they're developmentally in terms of their sexuality, there may be big gaps.
I think that there are resources, and there is some basic encouragement for members to teach their children about sexuality, but in perspective, with all the sexual messaging we get, I would say 90% is very fear-based, very adolescent-driven, very much about keeping yourself, you know, pure and modest and saving yourself for marriage, and then very little conversation about what to do then, and because it's sacred and between spouses, you know. So those are I think, challenges that we do have, and therefore, like you've stated, many people get married with not too much experience, or if they do have experience, a lot of guilt or shame around that experience, which also colors their sexual journeys together, and then not a lot of know-how, and with difficulty knowing how to talk about it, right? So typically I see people that have been married about 10 or 15 years and are finally coming in after a long time of really struggling with some pretty common issues, you know, not overly dramatic issues necessarily, but without the understanding of how to get help for those things.
Yeah, and I mean, there are various approaches, and it obviously depends on the couple and the individuals in the couple, but to give them the opportunity for each one of them to tell their story from each quadrant of the wheel can sometimes just be mind-blowing and so relieving. Or sometimes I'll give them each an exercise to say to one another, fill in the blanks. I would really like to dot, 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 but I scare myself by imagining that dot, dot, dot. I would really like to, I don't know, make love out in the open under a sunset, but I scare myself by imagining that God would strike us dead, or a church member would find us and report us, or whatever it might be. But I find that to give people some suggestions or exercises that make them laugh, even. It can be really helpful because it takes away the anxiety and the oppression and the high seriousness of everything. I mean, sex is about having fun as well as connecting with a higher power and with your partner. So how do you have fun? I really love to work with people at that level and work with laughter.
Yeah, that's lovely. I like laughter too. Well, so can we talk a little bit about some of these scripts that you mentioned that can get in the way of claiming one's desire? So I'm just going to rattle off a few of these and then you can tell me which ones you want to approach. But you talk about like a performance script. Mm-hmm. You talk about a romantic script, the good girl script you've mentioned a little bit of, the oh God script. Mm-hmm. And then eventually you end on, you know, really finding a partnership model. So can we talk about some of these scripts, which I think is really another way to talk about expectations of self and sexuality that sometimes get in the way of desire?
Sure. I mean, everyone in this culture has some kind of performance script. All you have to do is turn on your TV and you see ads for performance-enhancing drugs. Need I say more? And the performance is uniformly face-to-face intercourse. Usually in the dark, usually in marriage, and often for the procreation of children, often man on top. This is cultural missionary position. And if you don't do it this way, and if you can't perform on demand, whether you're a man or a woman, gay, lesbian, or trans, if you can't do it the way that you see in the ads, then there's something wrong with you. And that's the performance message. And I think it's countered often by the romantic message, the romance model of sex, which is very old. Both of these are probably old, which says that you have to be in love before you can consummate your love with a sexual relationship. And again, this is about intercourse. This is not about sexual feeling. This is not about really opening your heart and connecting it with your body. It's that there needs to be a certain kind of romantic involvement, which in the Episcopal tradition I escaped from, included being married with a white veil and all of that stuff. So I think the more partnership model is about how can I listen to you? How can I listen to myself first? Because if I can't listen to myself, body, mind, heart, and spirit, there's no way that I can really listen to you. I can listen, but I'm not going to actually take it in. And there's no way that I can empathize. I had an amazing conversation with a woman recently who was in a long-term marriage. Loved her husband. Husband loved her. All signs were great. But he could not hear her. He could not translate. He would die for her. But if she asked for toast, he couldn't get that she didn't like her toast well done. She wanted her toast just done lightly. And this just seems like such a trivial example. But when I asked her to imagine two objects that could describe her love for him and for their life together. And on the other hand, an object to describe what she would like to change. The object that she imagined was a piece of burned toast. And that was so powerful to me because it was so ordinary. It's like, how do we listen to one another? And how do we tell one another? And this again is where I find the wheel or even the concept of the wheel to be so valuable. Because if I want you to make my toast the way I want it, let alone have sex the way I want it, where am I locating myself? Am I locating myself in my body, in my mind, in my heart, in my spirit, all of the above, etc.? And when you listen to me asking you for toast, which you leap up because you want, you would do anything for me, where are you with this when you can't hear, when you consistently cannot hear that I don't like my toast well done? Again, trivial example, but sometimes in just the tiny, most nuanced or subtle examples, you find the key to a relationship. And if you can unlock that, it's like the whole relationship slots into different connections.
Yeah, that's a really interesting example because it's this interplay too between, you know, listening to our partners and what they want, and also listening to ourselves and what we want, and how often those don't go hand in hand, right? And therein lies a struggle for many people. Like, I get that you want sex this way, or I can understand, but that doesn't necessarily do much to turn me on. And so how do we manage those, you know, what can feel very much like irreconcilable differences, or we're not sexually compatible then, you know, these really kind of doom and gloom messaging that people really feel hopeless about.
Right. And if you can walk couples through, I mean, just taking that toast metaphor, it seems as if it probably would be a fairly clear-cut, there would be clear-cut ways to work through how he could change the toaster setting so that she got toast that she wanted. But in the process of doing that, there's going to be brain chemistry that changes. There's going to be polyvagal response moving from flight, fight kind of defensive mechanisms to much more open yes kinds of mechanisms. There's probably going to be bilateral stimulation moving from one side of the brain to the next. I mean, we didn't get into the neurobiology of all of this sex and spirit, but as the neurobiology is coming out and being delineated more and more and more through more and more sophisticated scientific equipment, it's fascinating how the wheel, body, mind, heart, spirit, the thought of differentiating before you can integrate, and the actual sense of movement lines up with what science is now saying is quote unquote true.
Okay, so we're just at about an hour of time that you've spent with us, and I know you're very busy and have other things and places to go, but there's about 2 more hours that I want to talk to you. So I think you had mentioned that you'd be willing to come back for a part 2 to this conversation. Is that correct?
I would totally love that.
So that would be amazing. Yeah, that would be great. Because there's a lot of things that I think can be very clear directions for women to go with low desire, such as creating more erotic space in their lives, creating a relationship with themselves, etc. And those are things I'd like to talk with you in the future. But why don't we finish this particular podcast with this idea that you share of having a dominator type relationship versus having a partnership relationship. And not to turn people off, you know, dominator maybe seems like, oh, I'm not an abusive spouse, right? So I'm not a dominator. I think you mean something different by that. So maybe just clarifying that and giving women and couples a little bit of an idea of how they can make that shift.
Sure. Well, I chose these terms, dominator model and partnership model, from my friend and mentor, Rihanna Eisler, who in 1987 wrote an amazing book, which was a worldwide bestseller called The Chalice and the Blade. And instead of blaming men for everything that was wrong with women in this world, she said, really, if you look through history, there are what she labeled, quote unquote, dominator cultures and partnership cultures. And dominator cultures, for instance, and she cites many kinds of cultures, but for instance, Nazi Germany, where rules are very important and where there's a hierarchy, where some people are more important than other people, and class distinctions, where certain people make much more money than other people. In our society now, you see it being played out in our presidential primaries, where we're talking about the quote-unquote billionaire class and the working people. And so she's talking about these kind of dominator culture characteristics and partnership culture characteristics, where the economy is based on sharing. It might be an agrarian economy where I give you my wheat and you fix my car, or stuff like that. And in relationships, the same kind of thing happens, that we may have certain roles in relationships. I may do the dishes and you may go out and earn the money, but we don't attach importance to that because we're sharing. So I love these distinctions and loved them at the time I was writing this book, which was a while ago, because they didn't say feminist and, you know, good women and bad men, or patriarchal and feminist. So it wasn't attaching some kind of gender implication onto it. So fast forwarding onto how can we use this distinction in our relationships, you can ask yourselves, you know, are we relating together? First of all, am I relating to myself in a caring, loving way? Do I take care of myself? Or do I take a dominator stance and decide that I'm not worth as much as my children or my husband or keeping my house clean, so that instead of taking care of myself and listening to my body, mind, heart, spirit, I plunge myself into taking care of everybody else, doing good works. And I don't know why I'm having a nervous breakdown. So we have to look at our relationship with ourselves. And I always say that in terms of sexual relationships, the one long-term partner you will have all your lives long is yourself. And I'm not only talking about masturbation, in other words, touching your genitals for pleasure or orgasm, but I'm talking about body, mind, heart, spirit, that we need to take care of ourselves. The economy of self-care needs to be shared among all of our other people that we're caring for. I'm not saying don't care for other people. I'm saying put yourself in that mix. And then when it comes to partnership with your spouse, with your lover, I'm saying exactly the same thing. How are we sharing back and forth? How are you listening to me? If I ask you for toast that is not burned, can you hear that? Can you hear how important and significant it is for me? That you really pay attention to even the smallest things that I ask of you, because these move my heart. And for me to be clear, when I ask you for some token of your love, your affection, your sexual fidelity, if you will, your sexual interest, that I be clear where I'm locating myself when I'm asking. Am I asking from my heart? In which case, I might want you to say, I will love you forever. I might want some kind of romantic message. Am I asking you from my body? In which case, I might want a much more sensual message. Am I asking from my mind? In which case, I might get really excited by the ideas that we will generate back and forth. And am I asking from my spirit? In which case, it may be just a look. It may be a feeling. It may be some energy that both of us are able to intuit. It may be memories of all of the years that we've spent together. Whatever it may be, that I locate myself, that I'm clear in myself and to you, not only what I'm asking for, don't burn my toast, but where I'm asking it from. And so that you know how you can relate to me in a more, let's name it, erotic way. And by erotic, I mean life-giving, connected, spiritual, sensuous, heart-opening, and mind-blowing relationship.
That's lovely. You know, with this new drug that's just come out for low female desire, and you're really saying, look, this isn't something that pharmacology is going to be able to offer a solution to. This is really an inner journey, not only with a partner, but with yourself, something that's much deeper and more intimate and has more potential to really shift throughout a lifespan.
I agree with you, and a brain chip is not going to do that. Again, locating, if the pharmaceutical companies who are creating the brain chip are creating it from the mental place, and also from the place of, let's say, greed. How much money can we make off women or off men who want women to be sexual with them, no matter how many times they burn their toast? Then it's going to be incomplete. You know, it may work for some people. It may work some of the time. But ultimately, We're talking about a medicine wheel, however you conceptualize that, whether you conceptualize that as something that comes from Native American culture or indigenous cultures, or whether you can conceptualize it as a healing journey that you can take for yourself and with your partner, for the purpose of becoming more aware of yourself and each other, not of healing or fixing what's wrong with you, not necessarily of changing you, but simply acting for the purpose of awareness in the container of shared mutual love and respect.
Yeah, and then it really transcends certain behaviors. It really is more about a connection that includes, it can include the missionary position, it can include polyamory, it can include a variety of things, but the behavior is not the point. It's really more, where are we coming at towards the behavior?
Exactly. It's not about the fact of the burnt toast. It's about the process of the burnt toast.
Right. Well, I can't thank you enough for the time you've spent with us today. I know your time is extremely valuable. And are there any closing thoughts you'd like to leave us with before we invite you back on?
Well, I just want to thank you. I want to thank you for your openness in interviewing me and for being one with the wheel of experience. I love what you're putting out into the world as well.
Well, thank you. That's a real honor to hear from you. Thank you so much.
We took the long road home, turned minutes into miles. And as the evening traveled on, the sunset bathed your smile. We stopped beneath the desert stars, wrapped in each other's arms. Was as simple as I love you, an ordinary, extraordinary
a trail with tears, pain and sorrow too.
But through every storm we traveled on, like lovers do. And if sometimes we fell apart, we always came back home. Was as simple as I love you, an ordinary, extraordinary some people say, love is blind and forever is too long. sunrise. Can't imagine life alone. Let's take a long road on together until we're gone. Watch you by my side till the day I die and into the beyond. It's as simple as our love is. That's how I wanna go. All wrapped up in the arms of our extraordinary, it's nothing hard.